Listen to shoot the defence. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Welcome to Shoot the Defence on FNX, brought to you by My Sportswear and Save Association. I'm your host, Stel, and I'm thrilled to be joined by author of the novel Cashing In and contributor to 90sFootball.com, Sid Lambert. Sid, welcome to Shoot the Defence, mate. Thank you for joining me tonight.
Thanks very much for inviting me, mate. I'm looking forward to chatting some 90s football with you.
Great stuff. Well, look, mate, I mentioned Cashing In. What's that about, and what made you write a football novel?
Yeah, it's a strange one, isn't it? Because, I mean, Steve Bruce pretty much killed the football novel genre in the late 90s. Anyone who had the misfortune of reading his Striker series, that was like making your eyes bleed. But, I mean, there was a few different reasons, to be honest, Stel. I mean, first and foremost, I was a huge mark for Dream Team.
Right.
The Sky One series back in the day, I thought it was, I mean, I don't know if you must have seen it yourself, right?
Yeah, Linda Block. Yeah, I remember that.
Oh, we all loved a bit of Linda Block, didn't
yeah,
we?
Yeah.
Fletch.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was a brilliant idea because you had a fictional story within a real life setting. You had characters you cared about, storylines you cared about, within an environment that is normally so soulless and sanitised. So that was a big... big factors for me. One of the other reasons was I've probably read in my lifetime somewhere between 500 and 1,000 football books.
Wow.
And I can tell you what, they are so boring. Those football autobiographies, you know, cliche, wafer thin insight into the game. No one wants to offend anyone just in case, you know, it stops them getting a job later on as a pundit or whatever, or a coach. They're ghostwritten, they're not authentic, there's nothing interesting to say, so, you know, why do they bother? So I wanted to try and do something different, and I thought, two things really. Football was so much more interesting in the past. I mean, I still watch football, I love it, I play it to an appalling standard, but it's kind of lost its sense of, you know, chaos and fun, and it's lost the ability to laugh at itself, and it takes itself way too seriously. So I wanted to look at football through a very different lens. I think it's got a very cliched narrative. Everyone talks about, you know, kids who dream of fame and fortune. And I wanted to look at it in a totally different way. I wanted to have a really deep human story within a very real-life setting. So it's set in 1992-93 at the start of the Premier League. And it's about a guy called Ray Cash, who's a talented 19-year-old footballer. And it really, the way his life is turning out is something that we can all empathise with, because there are millions of us out there who go to work every day doing something we dislike, but we're good at it, and it pays the bills. And I wanted to pose that question. What if the one thing in life that you're really good at is something you hate doing?
Mm.
And that's the Ray Cash story. He's a very talented footballer. He's trapped in an identity, a life, an environment that you would give, or that you or I would love to be in, but he would give anything to escape from. And it just so happens that that environment is the most exciting, dramatic and crazy time in football history. So, yeah, lots of different reasons, and I think I've come up, certainly from the reviews that we've had, with something that a lot of people who listen to your show and a lot of guys who follow us over at 90sFootball.com are really enjoying.
Great stuff. So, how much research was actually involved in writing it, and did you actually speak to many people involved in the game?
Well, I mean, I do know quite a few people that are involved in the game, and, you know, at a younger age, I played with people, one or two went on to become pros, a few that did the sort of tried and tested route of having trials and then being rejected, but a lot of it was through research that I'd done, just reading book after book after book for years and years and years. And then really being disappointed with how, you know, the lack of interesting stories about football. I mean, no one wants to tell any of the sordid details.
Yeah.
And no one really wants to go into too much depth. So I pretty much knew the environment of the early years of the Premier League inside out. I'd read so much about all the different clubs. But the character itself isn't really based on any one individual. It's based on just an idea, which is, what if football isn't the dream that people think it is? And what if it is, in fact, for certainly for Ray Cash and for one or two pros that have since been sort of vocal about it, what if it's just a job? And what if, in fact, it's a job that you hate doing?
Yeah, I can completely agree with that. I mean, you do hear a lot of footballers who actually fallen out of love with the game because of experiences that they've had in the past, and it's a shame.
Yeah, it's a shame, but and normally they fall out of love because, you know, the game, maybe they ended badly, their career ended badly, maybe financially they didn't get the rewards that they were hoping for. But with Ray's story, it's different. It's one of kind of expectation that's piled upon him. And from an early age, the joy of football has just been absolutely drummed out of him. Mm. And by the time he gets to 19 and he's in a position to actually, you know, earn good sums of money in the whole new ball game in the Premier League, he's tired and he doesn't want to be involved anymore. And it's about how he then navigates through this crazy period of English football history, and really, he's in a world that he doesn't want to be in.
Right, I got you. Well, look, I hope you forgive me for saying this, but when I think football novel, I mean, the first one that pops into my head is Fever Pitch. Now, were you at all concerned people would actually draw comparisons between your work and Nick Hornby's?
No, listen, I'll be brutally honest. Nick Hornby's book is a really brilliant book. I've probably read that 5 times. I read it when I was about 14 years old. I read it when I was 18, 22. I loved it. Fantastic book. Nick Hornby is a very, very good writer, and he's he's capable of taking a very serious subject and treating it sensitively. What I would class cashing in as, and I was chatting to it about on the show the other day, is I would class it as a great bog read.
Right.
You know, it is not going to win the Booker Prize. That's not what we're here for. It is a fun story. There's loads of nostalgia in it. It's absolutely caked in statistics and all the kind of real-life Premier League results and names and all that kind of thing. And the story itself, whilst it is, you know, a serious one, Ray is a serious character, there are loads of laughs in there along the way. So I was never, ever going to compete with the likes of Nick Hornby. Because, you know, you have to know your limits.
Mm. Yeah, but let's be honest, I mean, Fever Pitch was a crap film though, wasn't it?
Oh, absolute dross, mate. Yeah, never again. Gave up after about 30 minutes. Rubbish, not for me. So, talk about ruining a book.
Yeah, so you were the one, a film director, to make a film out of your book, no?
Well, depends who it was. I mean, if it's Michael Bay, I mean, we'd probably struggle, to be honest. I mean, you'd probably have someone blow up Old Trafford. We're going to struggle there.
Mate, I've got to be in my bonnet about Michael Bay. He's messed up the Transformers films for me. I mean, I love growing up watching Transformers, and he ruined it.
Well, I used to watch Transformers when it was on at the end of Rugged and Rap.
Yeah.
I would happily watch that ahead of any minute of cinematic fare that Michael Bay has put together.
I agree.
Absolute crap.
I agree. 100%. Even the Transformers animated movie was better than what they created.
Yeah, sad when Optimus Prime died. Well, there's a spoiler alert, but maybe we'll move on from there before I get tearful.
Well, mate, I've been reading your blogs on 90sfootball.com, and it's somewhat of a trip down memory lane. I mean, I'd ask what your earliest memories of the 90s are, but then you just refer me back to your articles. Now, I know, and you know, that the 90s were incredibly exciting. We had Italian 90, Euro 92, and of course, the birth of the Premier League. Now, let's briefly talk about Italian 90 and Euro 92, because both of them had remarkable stories. I mean, first came Cameroon's shock victory over world champions Argentina, leading on to a fantastic World Cup campaign. Then there was the first real surprise tournament win, which was Denmark's Euro 92 victory. What do you remember most about both tournaments?
Well, interesting story. When Argentina lost to Cameroon in the opening day, so that was June the 8th, 1990, I was actually in the BBC studios, because I had won a competition to be on Newsround.
Wow.
So, yeah, that was it. I was standing shoulder to shoulder with the legend that was Terry Bahou.
No way.
And, yeah, the big man himself, Big T. And we were watching the game and the result come in, and there was an absolute sense of shock around the BBC studios, and I was part of that. So that's an early memory for me. Euro 1992, I think you remember, probably, although I think Gareth Southgate's men might give this a good push, for being the worst ever England squad in international tournament history.
Yeah.
But like I say, Gareth could probably give that a go this next year. But that's my one memory. But I mean, Italia 90 for me is still the greatest international tournament of all time. It's probably because I'm looking back on it in rose-tinted glasses. You know, all the romanticism around England, all the incredible players, the likes of Matthäus, Klinsmann, you know, Roger Miller, all those stories, Gazza, of course. But for me, it's my favourite international tournament.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree with you. I think that was the first World Cup that I remember most. I mean, I remember Mexico 86, but it's not strong in my mind kind of thing, because I was only five at the time. So I mean, I remember certain bits, like obviously the hand of God. I remember watching that at my cousin's house and he was livid. But Italia 90 for me was the best. And I remember Thomas Kuravi's hat-trick of headers for Czechoslovakia, as they were back then. You know, there was a Donadoni at Inter, Toto Schillaci, who came on the scene. And as you mentioned, the three Germans, and that incident with Rudi Völler and Frank Rijkaard.
Oh yeah, and that incredible moment where he spits in his ear.
Yep.
I mean, there'd be absolute outrage. Yep. Everyone just sort of got on with it. Yeah, one of them got a red card. You know, let's get on with the game, lads.
Yep.
Thomas Kuravi, that is a great pick for Newstel. I mean, Thomas Kuravi's mullet.
Yes.
Really, when he dies, it should be immortalised somewhere
in some
sort of world football museum, or there should be some sort of bronze statue of his hair, as it was in Italia 90, in Sepp Blatter's empty office, because it was a thing of absolute beauty.
Yeah.
And for a man to have that quality of hair and still be as good as heading a ball was really unheard of. It really was special, wasn't it?
Yeah. See, that's the thing about World Cups. You always remember one or two standout moments, but Italia 90 practically had hundreds. I mean, look at Rene Higuita. Do you remember him? He came running out. No one actually saw a sweeper keeper before. No one ever imagined a rush goalie happening in real life. You kind of did it when you're at the park with your mates, rush goalie and all that. But when you see Rene Higuita running out and then having the ball nabbed from him, that was one, wasn't it?
Well, and he had hair like Tina Turner.
Yes.
I mean, there was a lot to appreciate about Rene Higuita, but that was a great moment. Roger Miller's little dance by the corner flag. But what's great as well is when you watch highlights of some of it and revisit it, that England-Ireland game in 1990 Oof. Probably has a case for being the worst ever game of association football.
Yeah.
I mean, it was absolutely filthy. It was rotten. But I can still watch the highlights happily without, and that's what I mean about rose-tinted glasses. There was so much excitement about that tournament and the players we had and the fact that we were playing Ireland that I can still look back and enjoy those rotten, rancid highlights just as much, you know, as I would happy watching a seven-goal thriller today. And of course, you know, where in international football these days do you get the England captain shitting himself on the pitch?
And then dragging his ass across the turf.
It's a lost art style, isn't it? You know, Gary Lineker having the poo on the pitch, wiping it on the sodden turf while Stuart Pearce starts laughing.
Yeah.
You know, you tell me any player in the world that could pull that off with the sort of aplomb that Gary Lineker did. It was magnificent.
Yeah, and you kind of followed that kind of performance at Euro 92 as well, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It gave us some memorable moments, didn't it?
Oh, blimey. Do you know what? I kind of feel for Lineker a bit, because I'll never forget he missed that penalty against Brazil in the warm-up before Euro 92, didn't he? And that was the chance.
Terrible penalty.
The chance to level it up with Sir Bobby Charlton. And then he went into the Euros and we're thinking, yeah, he's going to break it there. And then his last game in an England shirt, he gets taken off for Alan Smith.
Heartbreaking. I think, though, with Graham Taylor's tactics, you know, in his style of football and his absolute insistence on having no flair players in the team, that Gary could probably have been playing for 10 more years and he wouldn't have scored.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, Graham Taylor's England team, that, like I said, that one we took to Euro 92, when your midfield's Carlton Palmer, you know, and you've got Andy Simpson on the left, things aren't going to go great for you, are they? No. I mean, that was an awful, awful squad.
Yeah.
Really, comparatively, compared to what, you know, what we had in the later years, when you look at what we took to 96, just 4 years later. That really was a dreadful team.
Yeah, in fact, they actually performed worse than the Commonwealth of Independent States. I think that was the only national team that had letters in their flags, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I used to get confused with CNA, that was like a fabric and hardware store. I just could never get that one right. I think Jimmy Greaves did as well. But then again, Jimmy Greaves got confused by my seat.
Yeah. Crikey, see? Getting all nostalgic here, mate. Brilliant.
I love it, yeah.
I'll tell you what, is one, Blast from the Past, Orbis Football Collection. Do you remember that?
I do. I mean, there were so many. If you talk about the best football collections, I used to love the Corinthians figures.
Yep.
Which some of them looked absolutely nothing like the people they were intended to be.
Yeah.
You just couldn't have pulled them out of the lineup. But for me, I used to love Proset. Do you remember Proset?
Yeah.
The cards that replaced, well, they didn't replace, but there were stickers sort of went out of fashion a little bit, and people were swapping Proset cards. And I remember that Paul Walsh, who was playing at Tottenham at the time, if you found Paul Walsh, it was basically like finding, you know, buried Nazi gold worth millions. He was absolutely gold dust. You just couldn't find Paul Walsh on Proset anywhere. No. Certainly not where I grew up, anyway. No. Within a 5 mile radius, if someone had Paul Walsh, they were just knocking on his door.
Oh, Walshy. I wonder what he's doing with himself now. Blimey.
Yeah. I did have a little dalliance with getting Panini stickers again about 6 years ago, but it just wasn't the same. Surprisingly, you know, trying to find other 30-somethings in your workplace who want to swap stickers, just didn't have quite the same pull.
Yeah. I mean, my cousin did the whole European Championships sticker book, but he bought, you know, the whole box full of stickers, so he had about...
Cheating.
But he just wanted to complete it straight away, and I still think he had about 150 to finish, but anyway, oh well. Right, so the 90s, we saw the return of British clubs in European competition after the ban, or should I say Thatcher pulling them out, so to speak. Were you surprised to see United win the Cup Winners' Cup straight away?
That cup run really was something special, really, because United had what was really a fairly ordinary team.
Yeah.
Whenever you've got Clayton Blackmore in your side, you know, you're not really thought of as, you know, well, the best teams around. But actually, in fairness, Clayton Blackmore scored a couple of absolute screamers during that cup run.
Yeah.
I think he scored one in Montpellier for about 40 yards.
Yeah.
And that cut run was just brilliant to watch. I mean, the goals, when you look at them back, the goal where Mark Hughes rounds the keeper, and he's at this absurd angle, and he doesn't even try and place it, he still just puts his foot through the ball and it arrows absolutely straight into the corner.
Yeah.
That was, it was a brilliant cut run by United. And this was when they were still, you know, they were still finding themselves as a side, really. They'd still been quite, you know, unstable. Ferguson signed about 45 players and 25 of them were rubbish. Yeah. So they were still sort of finding their identity a bit. I do remember that cup run vividly and thinking it was just fantastic.
Yeah, and the thing is, you can say Ferguson was a genius, which I agree. I mean, he won the Cup Winners' Cup with Mal Donaghy in his squad.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible, really, isn't it? absolutely amazing that some of the players he signed, they were absolutely hopeless.
Yeah.
I mean, bless him, he signed Ralph Milne when Ralph Milne was certainly not the player he used to be. There were a lot of rubbish players. I mean, everyone talks about Poborski, obviously, who it seems had one good game for international level, and that was enough to convince Ferguson to part with a lot of money for him. Mm. But yeah. So, certainly, most out of his players.
Yep, absolutely. Well, we mentioned Italian 90 earlier, and I can't not mention Paul Gascoigne, who obviously stole the hearts of the nation during that tournament. So, it wasn't really much of a surprise his move to Lazio was met with a lot of attention. Now, this obviously led to the inception of Football Italia on Channel 4. Now, the show introduced us to somewhat of a technical side of domestic football, one we obviously weren't used to seeing. Now, I remember people saying Italian football was boring. I mean, it wasn't that bad, was it?
It wasn't that bad at all. And if you look at the results, I was reading about this the other day, if you look at the results during that first season, some of the games Channel 4 had were ridiculous. They were like 5-4s and 5-3s. Beppe Signori, do you remember Beppe Signori?
Yeah, he always had, his boots were one size too small.
He was a tiny little bloke, wasn't he? And he had hair like Gail Platt off Coronation Street. Absolutely terrible varlet, but what a left peg.
Yep.
He was scoring every week. I just think we just weren't used to it. We were just used to people passing forward, and it wasn't even really passing forward. It was knocking it long, chasing it down the channel. It was all hustle and bustle. And it took us a little while to adjust to the new tempo, but we were lucky, weren't we, still? Because we had the genius that was James Richardson to help guide us through this mythical world of foreign football.
And he always had those newspaper reviews, didn't he? Always had a newspaper, Gazzetta d'Italia, Gazzetta dello Sport, and all these other ones. And he actually isn't Italian, is he? He learned it from a girlfriend, I think. He was dating a girl from Rome, and he learned it from her, didn't he, or something like that?
Well, let's be honest, he could have made it all up for him, wouldn't he? He was pretty much at the time, what was it, 1992, he was probably the only English bloke who spoke Italian. He could have made the whole lot up, and none of it was funny. And he was sat in a different piazza with a different suit jacket on every week, and he looked the part, didn't he? He looked the absolute business. I used to love Football Italia, especially the occasionally odd skits they did with Gazza.
That's right, yeah.
Where it was clear that he was absolutely batshit crazy, and he was going out of his mind in Italy through boredom, and he would just come up. They would just come up with these chaotic skits that would fill 5 minutes of TV on a Saturday morning.
And do you know what, we hear these stories about Gascoigne these days. Can you imagine how many stories the Italians have about him? Because out there, the cultural difference is completely it's huge, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the thing was, I don't think they'd ever seen a player like Gazza.
No.
They certainly never seen anyone that could drink like him. they'd never seen anyone that could that would play the practical jokes that he played. I don't think they'd ever seen probably a worse professional instead of, you know, in terms of health and fitness. I remember the story that he got there for the first day. This was after he recovered from his injury, and he was with Dino Zoff, the legendary Italian manager. And he put him through his paces in training, and after about 20 minutes, you know, Dino Zoff said, you know, right, that's enough. And Paul Gascoigne was absolutely knackered. It turned out that was just a warm-up. He couldn't believe that was just a warm-up, because that was the hardest he'd ever worked in football training. So he was... it was a bit of a fish out of water, but we shouldn't forget, should we? Do you remember who the other Englishman abroad was during that season?
Hang on, David Platt, Des Walker.
That's the one I'm thinking of. Yeah. Big Des.
Wasn't there? Who's the other guy that was at Chelsea? And he was at Celtic as well. Wasn't he out there as well? I forget his name. Got injured. I think.
Paul Elliott.
Paul Elliott. Yeah, wasn't he out there as well?
No, Paul Elliott was. He'd come back. He joined Chelsea from Pisa.
Right.
Okay. So by then he was already back in English football. In fact, I just blogged about it about 3 weeks ago. Was the anniversary, the 25-year anniversary of Paul Elliott's last game in English football, which is when he got absolutely nailed by Dean Saunders at Anfield in a Liverpool Chelsea game.
Yeah.
And it was a real sad loss, because he was an excellent player. But I was thinking about Des Walker, who went from being a star, you know, the man you'll never beat, Des Walker, to essentially being a donkey. And I think he was voted that first season in Italy, I think he was voted the worst foreign player.
That's the hell. Wow.
The Italian game just wasn't suited. It's just because basically he wasn't very good with the ball.
Well, I mean, it's a completely different game, isn't it? Or even then, completely different game.
Well, yeah, I mean, all of a sudden he was being asked to pass instead of to head and intercept. depth and pass it back to the goalkeeper.
Yeah.
So, but credit to Des Walker, of course, he came back and he had about six really good years at Sheffield Wednesday. That's so right. I was glad to see him back in English football.
Yeah, he's a good player. He's a very good player. Well, mate,
brilliant player.
Well, when Brian Deane became the first goal scorer of the Premier League, I doubt anyone actually imagined how big the league would become. I mean, I'm actually legitimately surprised with how much it's grown and evolved. What do you reckon? What do you make of it?
Well, Brian Deane became the most popular Trivial Pursuit question of all time, didn't he?
That's right.
With that one. I don't think any of us back then, I mean, I can remember being absolutely stunned at the amount of football that was on telly that first Premier League season. Because if you remember, the Match used to be ITV's coverage, and it wasn't even on every week.
No.
And you never even knew what game was going to be on until about 2 days before.
Yep.
You literally had no idea what was going to come on, and you were just thankful if you saw anything. So I was just remember being blown away by the amount of football content that I could watch. It was just brilliant to me. But I never, you know, would have been impossible back then to think that you would get the likes of Sergio Aguero and, you know, Kevin De Bruyne and Lukaku and all these fantastic players that are here today, because, you know, you look at that first season and our star players were like Chris Kiwumya.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, Chris Kiwumya, right. And John Fashanu.
That's right.
Dean Holdsworth. You know, I remember being absolutely stunned. I saw Ruud Gullit's first, I saw his friendly debut for Chelsea. He was down at Gillingham. And it was like seeing a god walk onto the pitch. Yeah. I just couldn't believe that we had a player of this magnitude playing in English football. And not only that, he was playing next to Eddie Newton.
That's superb. It's fantastic. I mean, a good friend of the show, Leon Knight, he was at Chelsea at the time when they had, you know, your Desai's, your Kasiragis, your Zolas. And he's got story upon story upon story. And even one with Winston Bogard, which will go down in history, where the guy just walks in every week, or every month, should I say, doesn't get a game for Chelsea, but he just walks into the dressing room and says, do you know what day it is? It's payday, and I'm buying another Ferrari. It's
yeah, Winston Bogart, he nicked the dream, didn't he? Paid a fortune to do nothing. I saw a great story the other day on YouTube that was really worth watching. It was Jason McAteer, who's always worth listening to, because his stories, mainly about him normally, where he's the butt of the joke, are always good fun. But he was talking about Liverpool, you know, when they were the Spice Boys, went to Old Trafford, big, you know, heated derby game, massive rivalry and all that. Liverpool were defending a corner, and Gary Pannister's unmarked, and everybody knows that before the game they'd all said Razor Ruddock was going to mark Gary Pannister. So they're looking around at the corner, going, you know, where's Razor? Where is he? Why isn't he marking Pannister? And Neil Ruddock's actually standing against the post at Old Trafford with his old fella out, having a whiz. He's draining the weasel during a Premier League football game whilst defending a set piece at Old Trafford. Now, that for me is top class.
Yep.
You know. We don't get enough of that, do we?
No, not at all. Don't get it at all, actually. Don't get it at all.
No.
Blimey, that's fantastic. That's a great story. Well, speaking of stories, I mean, what would you say your most favourite moments and players from the 90s, mate?
I can't go to sleep at night without seeing Tony Yeboah's goals for Leeds. Do you remember the volley against Liverpool?
Yeah, yeah.
The absolute screamer he scored against Leeds. Sorry, four leads against Wimbledon.
That's right.
They're great moments for me. Do you remember Yeboah well?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, very well. Very well. He joined from wasn't it a German club? Eintracht Frankfurt he joined Leeds
it
from.
It was from Frankfurt. And of course, unless you read World Soccer, or maybe 90 Minutes, you had absolutely no idea who he was.
That's right. That's right.
And he just turned up, and he was absolutely fantastic. I mean, I'm what team do you support, Stel?
Man United.
Oh, Man United. So for you, you've got loads of great memories. I'm a West Ham fan. Memories of the 90s for me tend to revolve around Julian Dix.
All right. Yep.
Yeah, and a lot of relegation battles, certainly in the early days. So I've got a lot of love for Julian. Also, just the influx of foreign players, you know, and some of the really crap ones as well.
Marco Bugas.
Marco Bugas, you know. Incredibly, there was a list the other day that came out that said that the top 50 worst foreign players in the Premier League, and somehow Marco Bugas only got 30.
Really?
Yeah.
Ali Dia's got to be the first one, surely.
Yeah, Ali Dia was first. Marco Bugas was 30. He should have been top five. Absolutely terrible. People like Andrea Silenzi, what a terrible, terrible player he was, and he was brought in to replace Dan Collymore.
That's right.
I think my fondest memories are just about the influx of these foreign players, some brilliant, some terrible, some so bang average it was unbelievable, and just our memories of all of them playing for our clubs. I mean, at one stage, it felt like we were being invaded by Scandinavians, didn't we?
That's right, yeah. I think, to be honest, I think Liverpool are probably the worst for that, though. I remember they had players like, what's it called? Torben Pieknik, Stiginger Bjørneby. Who else did they have? They had Isfan Kosmar as well. Remember him?
Yeah, I remember Isfan Kosmar, very well. He was part of the Graham Souness revolution at Liverpool. And if you term a revolution as getting rid of all your good players and replacing them with crap ones, which is essentially what Graham Souness did. I mean, that's the thing. In my 90s football blog at the moment, we're going week by week through the 92-93 season, and Liverpool are an absolute shambles.
Yeah.
Absolute shambles back at that time. Honestly, it's got to be the worst team they've ever had.
I know, and they won the FA Cup the year before as well, didn't they?
Yeah, they did, although, I mean, it was a terrible final. Yeah. I mean, they were against Sunderland, who were essentially a one-man team. They had Johnny Byrne up front, the Irishman, who had a brilliant tournament, and it was a terrible final. I think Michael Thomas scored, and I can't remember who got the other one.
Was it Ian Rush? Did Ian Rush?
It might have been Rush. Yeah, it might have been Rushy.
Ian Rush? Might have been, yeah. Yeah, it might have been, because I remember his last ever touch in a Liverpool shirt was to deflect the ball to Cantona in the cup final.
Oh, that was a terrible game, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was bad. But they've been really bad finals, haven't they, over the years, you know? But obviously that one was hyped to the stars, I guess. But you mentioned that Liverpool team, a good friend of the show, Paul Stewart, was actually part of that Liverpool squad. I don't think you like me.
He signed for big money from Tottenham, he'd done pretty well. I mean, he'd scored in the FA Cup final in 1991, I think. And I think injuries sort of caught up with Paul Stewart during that time. So he'd got an England cap. Graham Taylor had given him a go, and then he just seemed to lose momentum. And I remember he ended up at Sunderland for a while, didn't he?
Yeah, because the thing is, he was another trivia guy, because I think he was the first player to play in a Merseyside derby, a Manchester derby, a North London derby, and a Tyne-Wear derby.
He was at his peak, really. If you look at Paul Stewart and you look at the YouTube highlights of him at Manchester City, when they had players like him and David White, they were some attacking team back then. But just talking about cup finals, still, as a United fan, you've got to say that the best FA Cup final or FA Cup semi-final day ever started right back at the start of the decade. Do you remember when they used Oldham? To have both finals?
Well, we played Oldham? Is that the one you mean?
Yeah, that's the one. Oldham, and in the morning, the sort of lunchtime kickoff, we'd had Crystal Palace versus Liverpool.
Yeah, that was a fantastic semi-final, wasn't it?
Absolutely unbelievable. Yeah. Palace were, they didn't even have their best team out because Ian Wright wasn't even fit, so John Solarco was playing up front. Right. They'd been smashed 9-0 by Liverpool earlier in the season.
That's right.
They beat them 4-3. And if you just about had enough time to recover from that game, and you went into Manchester United against Oldham.
Yep.
And, that was absolutely breathtaking. And I used to, in the playground, I used to pretend I was Danny Wallace.
Wow.
I loved Danny Wallace. I thought he was brilliant. When in fact, at that stage, he wasn't doing so well. But he scored in that game. Yeah, and I just remember him bolting down the wing just continually. You probably don't have that many fond memories of Danny Wallace, but I certainly do.
Well, do you know, to be honest, he was a half-decent player. I mean, he had bags of pace, he was very strong for a small guy. But again, as you said, I think he was unlucky with injuries, and what happened to him later on in life is quite sad, to be fair. But you mentioned...
Well, I saw him in 2005. He did the London Marathon, would you believe?
Yeah.
So even, obviously, by this stage, he's been, you know, severely affected by his illness. And he took him a week to do the marathon because he was so tired each and every day. And I saw him on day six, and it was like being a kid in the playground again. And he could not have been a nicer bloke.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've heard nothing but good things about him, to be fair. And his brother was a half decent player as well, wasn't he?
Rod Wallace. Never. I'm not even sure Rod Wallace got an England cap. Probably should have done.
It might have done under Graham Taylor.
Well, most people did. I think he might have got an England B cap, but I mean, these days, if he scored that goal he scored for Leeds against Tottenham, where he dribbled round about five players and curled it in the corner, that'd probably guarantee you 50 caps.
Yeah, I think he played for the under-21s, but I don't think he played for the full 11.
Yeah, he might have done. You might be right. You might be right. But yeah, he was a sort of 90s icon, wasn't he, Rod?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, mate, it's been fantastic talking to you about the 90s. I hope you can come back on again and we can do this again sometime. It's been absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I love talking about it, mate. I'd love to come on again. We'll talk about whatever you want. I'll just say to anyone who's listening, if they want to go to 90sfootball.com, we are reliving week by week the 92-93 season, and it's throwing up some absolutely great names. Mick Harford's featuring regularly.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big name for you and a big bloke, in fairness.
Yeah.
We've already had the Liverpool-Chelsea game, the warfare after Paul Elliott. Pretty soon, we've got Eric Cantona's move from Leeds to Man United coming up. It's just brilliant to go back, look at the results, look at the goals, look at the stories, and sort of relive it all again. So I'd encourage anyone to sort of get involved and, come and appreciate, you know, a little bit of nostalgia. And if they want to know a bit more about the book, go on to Amazon. It's on my Twitter profile, which is @Sid_Lambert. It's a shameless plug here. We've got an average of 4.9 stars after 30-odd reviews.
And
people say that they love the nostalgia.
That's
and they
brilliant.
Love the story, so, you know, give it a go.
Great stuff. Well, you know what, you've done my job for me, because I was about to ask you where we can find you and your material. But yeah, listen, I advise everyone that, you know, obviously people that believe that football was created after 96, which it wasn't, visit 90sfootball.com, because, you know, I took a look earlier, and I'll tell you what, a lot of the stuff that, especially your material, I was like, wow, you've reminded me of how things were, and I've reminded of this game, like Dalian Atkinson's goal at Wimbledon, where the fan came on the pitch with the umbrella. I mean, that's just phenomenal.
It's iconic, isn't it? It's absolutely iconic, moments like that. And there would be, already that season, they were blessed with some brilliant goals.
Yeah.
And like I say, it's great to sort of go through it and remember what it was like.
Yeah, like Staunton's goal against United in the 1-1. That was a cracker.
Screamer.
Yeah.
Absolute screamer.
Yeah.
Dean Saunders scored one. That Tony Gubber, I think, on commentary, just said it was the goal of the century.
Yeah.
It didn't even win goal of the month. That's how good it was. That's how good that season was.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We'll see it again. Thank you very much for your time, mate. Really appreciate it. And look forward to speaking to you soon.
Pleasure, mate. All right.
Fantastic.
Speak again soon, yeah?
All the best. Have a good night.
Cheers.
Take care.